or red. The male mallard is really a beautiful bird. Of course, that doesn't stop me from dropping them from the sky whenever I'm given the chance. I made the mallard hen call first because most ducks will respond to that kind of sound. We still make the original commander call today, and each one tends to sound different because every one is still made by hand from wood. Of course, we still blow on every call to make sure it sounds exactly right. The original commander call is the quintessential duck quack, and the mallard hen typically gives the call in a series of 2 to 10 quacks that start loud and get softer as she goes. Sounds a lot like a woman I know at home. Now, not all mallard hens sound exactly the same. When you're blowing on an original commander call to attract a mallard hen, you can quicken and sharpen the cadence to replicate a young mallard hen, or slow down and draw out the cadence to get an old raspy mallard hen. There are 3 distinctive sounds for a mallard hen: quack, feed call, and hail call. The mallard hen call is very versatile and effective. The mallard drake call came along next. We were the first company to build one, so we patented it so our competitors couldn't copy our design. The male mallard doesn't quack. It's more of a quiet, raspy sound. When I set out to build the mallard drake, I superglued various sizes of PVC pipe together and finally mastered it. When I finally built a call that sounded exactly like a male mallard, I went tearing into our house and told Miss K, "I have it! We're going to revolutionize duck calls as we know them." I blew on the mallard drake call for her. "What is that?" she asked me. "Is it a frog?" If you blow too high on a mallard drake call, you really do sound like a tree frog, and there's no meat on those suckers. You have to catch the plump bullfrogs if you want a meal. The mallard drake call is different from any other duck call. With most calls, you say 10, 10, 10 while you're blowing into it. But with the mallard drake, you're basically saying ah on a very low bass note as you raise your fingers off the call. It's an easy thing to do unless you're a tenor. The mallard drake call is controlled by your vocal cords and is really a whistle with a stem on it. You have to remember that when you're on an amplifier, whether it's with a guitar or any other musical instrument, you get maximum vibration when you hit a bass note. So you have to go really, really low when you're calling mallard drakes. Conversely, there are 3 types of ducks that are whistlers: teal, wigeon, and pintail. Believe it or not, I built our first whistle from a children's musical toy set. None of the flutes and horns in the toy set sounded like a duck, but after I spent an hour with a bandsaw and used plenty of super glue, I built a whistle that sounded like 6 birds. For pintails, you put your finger in the opening while you're blowing. For wigeons and teals, you blow straight into the whistle. You can even use our whistle to call mallard drakes, doves, or quails if you want. That's why we call our whistle a 6-in-1 call. The green-winged teal is the smallest of the North American dabbling ducks. It has a short neck and small bill, and its chestnut head has a green eye patch that extends to the nape of its neck. It's another pretty bird. Male green-winged teals have a high-pitched, single-note peep sound, while females are relatively quiet. But the females will let out a sharp, high-pitched quack when they're flushed. Like most women, you'll know when they've been bothered. When you're calling a green-winged teal, you don't do it very loud, and you use fine little short notes while you're blowing air directly into the whistle. It's almost like a miniature mallard hen call, but when you get 4 or 5 people peeping at the same time, it's exactly what teals sound like on the water. There are also blue-winged teals and cinnamon teals, and they're identifiable by the colors their names suggest. The blue-winged teals, which have blue-gray upper wings, are common in the northern prairies and parklands of the central United States. We see a few blue-winged teals every once in a while, but they tend to winter farther to the south. The male has a high-whistled teet-teet sound, while the female lets out loud, evenly spaced quacks. The blue-winged teals are a lot of fun to hunt because they fly very fast and make erratic twists and turns as they fly low over your decoy spreads. The cinnamon teal, which has a cinnamon red head, neck, breast, and belly, are common around the Great Salt Lake in Utah and the central valleys of California. They winter in Mexico and other parts of Central America, so we don't see them in Louisiana. The male sentimental makes a series of chuck notes, while the female gives off more of a quack. We see a lot of American wegeons, which are also known as ball pates and have a bluish-gray-tipped bill. The males have a white crown on their heads and a green face patch. The wegeon drake gives out three high, squeaky whistles like, whee-whee-whee. To call a male wegeon, you stick the whistle in the corner of your mouth and clench your teeth. You blow three times and make sure you accent the second sound. The female wegeon, which has a gray head with a brownish-black crown, gives out a quack sound. We usually end up seeing a lot of American wegeon ducks. They nest in parts of Canada and are usually the first to migrate south for the winter. The northern pintail is a long, slim duck with long, narrow wings, a slender neck, and a long tail. You can't mistake a pintail for any other kind of duck. Some people call them the greyhounds of the air, and the males have chocolate-brown heads with a white stripe on each side of their necks. The male lets out growling, guttural notes, and they're not easy to duplicate. If you look in the mirror, you'll see a round piece of meat hanging in the back of your throat. God gave us that piece of meat to call a pintail duck. If we didn't have it and couldn't flutter it as we blew air into a whistle, we'd sound like a backhoe backing up. Beep, beep, beep. But because God gave us that piece of meat, we can sound exactly like a pintail duck. The female pintail quacks and sounds nothing like a male. Now, I can't take credit for all the duck calls that Duck Commander has developed over the years. One time when my son Jace was hunting with me, he had a mallard hen call in one corner of his mouth and a whistle in the other and was blowing them at the same time. As Jace was blowing on both of them, a flight of gadwalls turned and came right down to our decoys. After we shot him, I asked Jace, "What were you doing down there? It sounded like a gadwall." "Why do you think they came down here?" Jace asked me. "They thought I was a gadwall." As with the mallard drake call, we were the first company to introduce a gadwall drake call. Gadwalls are about the same size as mallards, but there's really nothing very distinctive about them. The male gadwall is gray-brown with a black patch at its tail, while the females are patterned with brown and buff. The male gadwall makes short, deep, reedy calls that sound like a burp. The females quack like mallards, but with a higher pitch. To call a gadwall, you give the call one tat every 4 seconds or so. Unlike the gadwalls, wood ducks are very distinctive. They're the only ducks that perch and nest in trees. They have sharp claws, and they're comfortable flying through woods, hence their name. They also have a unique shape. They're boxy with crested heads, thin necks, and long, broad tails. The males have glossy green heads with white stripes, burgundy breast, and buff sides. The female wood ducks are gray-brown with white speckled breasts. The male wood duck has a thin, rising and falling whistle that sounds like tee. The female makes a loud oh-wee, oh-wee sound when flushed and screams cree, cree to sound an alarm. Keith Powell, who was one of my first employees at Duck Commander, built our first wood duck call out of wood. It has a short little reed in it, and you use your tongue to manipulate the sound. The key to calling wood ducks is you never want to use a flying call when the real ducks are flying. There's a different call for sitting, and that's the one you want to use when the ducks are in the air. If you're flying and the real ducks are flying, then everyone is flying, and no one knows where to land. If you call them to sit, they'll swim right up to your blind so you can shoot them. During the evolution of Duck Commander, we've built duck calls from wood, plastic, polycarbonate, and acrylic. We now have single-reeded calls, double-reeded calls, triple-reeded calls, and even reedless calls. We even have some calls today that are injection molded. Our calls come in a variety of colors and styles, but each call is still assembled by hand and custom-tuned to make sure it sounds like a duck. If it doesn't sound like a duck, it's fixed or thrown into a pile of rejects. Jace, Jep, Cy, John Godwin, Justin Martin, or one of a slew of other folks tests every duck call in the assembly room in our warehouse. I think our quality control is what separated our products from our competitors a long time ago. In the beginning, I was quality control. Even though we had the best product on the market, it took a while for sales to really pick up. In the late 1970s, I began to notice that Walmart stores were popping up in a lot of the small towns where I was doing business. Before too long, I noticed the hunting and fishing, sporting goods, and hardware stores that had previously bought my duck calls were closing their doors. I knew if I didn't find a way to get my products into Walmart, I wasn't going to be in business for very long either. So one day, I pulled my old truck in front of the first Walmart I saw, walked in, and said, "Hey, how many of these duck calls do you want here?" "Duck calls? You mean off the street?" the lady behind the counter asked me. Yeah, I answered mildly, noting her resistance. The clerk laughed and told me, "We don't buy any duck calls. Son, you need to go to Bentonville." "Bentonville?" I asked her, knowing Walmart's corporate headquarters was several hours away in Arkansas. "No, I've just got some duck calls right here." The clerk firmly told me no thanks and brusquely sent me away. So I drove on down the road and pulled up to the next few Walmart stores I saw. I changed my pitch a little bit to try to get someone interested, playing my tape and blowing my calls to show how they worked. Finally, one of the store managers told me, "I tell you what, you got an order form?" "No, I don't have an order form," I told him. "I just figured you could pay me out of petty cash back there in the back of the store somewhere." "Well, I've got a 3-part order form I need to fill out," he said. "I tell you what, I'll try 6 of them." When the store manager filled out a 3-part form with Walmart at the top of it and wrote down 6 duck calls, I walked outside looking at my copy and thought, "I've got me something here." Well, when I got to the next Walmart 30 miles down the road, I showed the store manager the form and told him, "Walmart stocking these duck calls. This last store ordered 6. He said, "Give me what you've got." That was the beginning of our Walmart business. Using the same technique, I amassed a stack of order forms to show and prove to managers of Walmart stores across 4 states that other stores were buying our duck calls. I eventually built the business, as our sales loop grew wider, to where we were selling $25,000 worth of calls to Walmart each year. Then one day our phone rang, and the voice on the other end said, "I need to talk to Mr. Robertson." "Yeah, that's me," I answered. "Are you the one who's getting duck calls into Walmart stores?" the man asked me. "Yes, that's me," I told him. "Son, let me ask you a question," he said. "How did you get duck calls into the Walmart chain without going through me?" "Well, just who are you?" I asked. "I'm the buyer for Walmart," he screamed. There was a pause. "One store at a time," I told him. There was a long pause. "Let me get this right," he said. "You mean to tell me you've been driving around your pickup truck and convincing our sporting goods departments to buy duck calls without even conferring with me, who's supposed to be doing the buying for the whole Walmart chain?" "Sir, I didn't mean to slight you or anything," I said. "Look, I didn't even know who you were. Bentonville's a long way. I'm just trying to survive down here." He thought about that for a minute, then said, "I'll tell you what I'm going to do. Anybody who can pull a stunt like that, I'm going to write you a letter authorizing you to do what you've been doing." "Man, I appreciate that," I told him. "I'm going to authorize you to go into our stores," he said. "You'll have that letter from me, and that makes it all above board." "Hey, I'd appreciate any help you can give me," I said. So the buyer in Bentonville wrote me a letter and sent it to me. I got the letter and showed it to every store manager I met. They all told me, "Come on in, Mr. Robertson." Our business with Walmart really started growing then. About a year or two later, with sales steadily accelerating, I called the buyer. "Look," I said, "it's a computerized world. We can probably speed this thing up if you buy a certain amount of my calls per store." The buyer told me to come to Bentonville and meet with him. He agreed to buy our calls and distribute them to Walmart stores, an action that eliminated a lot of our workload and expanded the sale of duck calls into new areas of the United States. Together, we eventually built the account to sales of more than $500,000 per year, big numbers for Duck Commander, but relatively small for Walmart. Our profit from the sales put us on solid ground financially and provided the base for our future growth. Things went on that way for about 20 years, but then Walmart began to scale down its waterfowl hunting business. Only about 1 million people in the United States hunt ducks. There wasn't enough money in it for a company that measures its customer base in multiple millions. We were making what we considered to be pretty good money, but it wasn't enough for Walmart, which deals in billions of dollars. The duck calls had always been more of a customer service for the company. So basically, they got out of the duck call business. Fortunately, we had expanded our business into other stores like Cabela's, Bass Pro Shops, Academy Sports Outdoors, and Gander Mountain, so we were no longer as dependent on one big contract like Walmart. The specialty hunting stores were not only buying our duck calls, but they were also stocking our hunting DVDs, t-shirts, hats, and other hunting gear. The independent hunting stores have long been some of our most loyal clients and are still a big part of our business today. Without them, we never would have gotten off the ground. Although we reestablished our business relationship with Walmart a few years later, Duck Commander was able to survive and prosper during the years in which we didn't do business with the world's biggest retailer. Duck Commander has been making hunting DVDs for more than two decades, although the first ones were actually filmed on VHS tapes. I watched a lot of deer hunting and big game hunting TV shows, and I was convinced there was a market for waterfowl hunting videos when perhaps no one else was. No one had really tried it with ducks, and I was certain we could do it better than anyone else. I rented camera equipment from a company in Dallas and hired Gary Stevenson, a science teacher at Ouachita Christian School, to film our first video. As with our duck calls, not a lot of other people believed my videos would be a success. In fact, Jace told me he was absolutely certain no one would watch them. Duckman 1, Duckman of Louisiana, was released in 1988 and sold about 100 copies. I set out to film Duckman 2, Point Blank, which took us the next five seasons to produce. We didn't know anything about making movies, and I had no idea it would take us so long to make a second hunting video. But I knew it was only a matter of time until people started noticing our videos. They were fun to watch. Duckman hunting takes were unlike what anyone else was doing at the time. We were blowing ducks' heads off in slow motion and flipping deer in the swamp. The videos lasted about an hour each and were among the first to include rock music over hunting scenes. I've always been a big fan of classic rock. I love Lynyrd Skynyrd, Led Zeppelin, Creedence Clearwater Revival, Pink Floyd, and Bob Seger. Lynyrd Skynyrd is definitely my favorite. If there's one rule at my house, it's that you never wake me while I'm napping. If you wake me before I'm ready, there's going to be heck to pay. One day, one of the members of Lynyrd Skynyrd called the Duck Commander office, wanting to talk to me. I was taking a nap at home, and the receptionist at the office was under strict orders not to wake me, so she took a message. I was so mad when I found out. I told everyone, from this day forward, wake me up at the President of the United States or Lynyrd Skynyrd calls. More than anything else, the Duckman videos put a face to our company. I had a long beard and so did most of the other original Duckmen, Mac Owen, Dane Jennings, and W.E. Red Dog Phillips. Red Dog was the first one to paint his face in the blind so the ducks wouldn't see him. He couldn't grow a long beard like the rest of us, so he figured he'd paint his face to look different. After a while, I figured out paint was the best way to camouflage our white faces from the ducks. Nothing stands out like a white surrender flag in a duck blind more than a white man's face. Now, everyone in my blind is required to wear face paint. People grew to love our DVDs. I think there was a shock factor involved, and people wanted to see what the crazy Cajuns in Louisiana would do next. In 2012, we released Resurrection, Duckman 16. The hunting DVDs ended up being a lot like our duck calls. We didn't hit a home run in our first at bat, but we kept going back up to the plate. Eventually, the hunting DVDs caught on and became popular enough to help Willie land us a show on Outdoor Channel, which led to even bigger things with Duck Dynasty on A&E. Even though Duck Commander faced difficult times and what seemed like insurmountable obstacles, we stayed the course and never gave up. I've always believed that if we did what was morally and ethically right, while continuing to steadfastly believe in what we were doing, we'd end up okay in the end. As long as we gave our best, continued to build products we believed in, and never strayed from God's purpose for us, I knew Duck Commander would find a way to persevere. It's what the Robertson family has always seemed to do. Chapter 11, Redneck Caviar. Rule number 11 for living happy, happy, happy. Suck the head of a crawfish. You'll want to do it again and again. After living more than 6 decades on Earth, I have reached the conclusion that ducks are the most protected species on the planet. In the United States of America, ducks are the most protected and overly regulated entity in history. It's amazing how many rules and regulations our government puts on duck hunters. If you don't believe me, check with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's website for all the up-to-date information. To even hunt ducks, I have to begin on a precise day at an exact minute, which is pretty difficult for a man who has never even owned a watch. I can't fire a shot until 30 minutes before the sun comes up, so I have to constantly look to see when the sun is going to rise and then deduct 30 minutes to determine when I can fire my first shot. Of course, the sunrise and sunset are constantly changing, depending on the rotation of Earth. But I always have to be aware of when the sun is going to come up because there might be a game warden sitting out there with a watch, waiting to write me an expensive ticket. The U.S. government also dictates that I can have only 3 shells in my shotgun at once, not 4 or 5, which would be a lot more efficient. I also have to have a precise kind of metal shot in my shells. It can't be lead, it has to be steel, so it's not harmful to the ducks or the environment. Where I live in eastern Louisiana, we are allowed to hunt ducks for 60 days each year. This past season, the first split of duck season started on November 17, 2012, and lasted 16 days. After a 2-week hiatus, duck hunting commenced again on December 15, 2012, and lasted 44 days until January 27. The government also tells me how many ducks I can kill, no more than 6 per day. But I also have to know what species of ducks I kill. I can't shoot more than 4 mallards, 2 pintails, 3 wood ducks, etc., and I have to know the sex of the ducks whose lives I've ended. If I wing a duck, shoot it down, and cripple it but don't kill it, I have to make a reasonable attempt to find it or I'm in violation of federal law. I'm telling you, it's the rule book of all rule books when it comes to duck hunting. Unborn babies don't have as much protection in this country. Here's the government's most silly rule. If I have a good day in the blind and want to give my buddy or a neighbor a few ducks to eat for dinner, I can't do it without documenting what I gave them. I have to write down my hunting license number, date of birth, legal name, physical address, and telephone number, and then specify how many ducks I'm giving them, what kind of ducks I'm giving them, and what sex of ducks I'm giving away. It's just one thing after the other when it comes to duck hunting. Here's another dilemma. The law says I can kill 6 ducks per day for 60 days in the Mississippi Flyway. I was never very good in math, but I believe that comes out to 360 ducks per season. But another federal law says I can only have a maximum of 12 ducks in my possession at once. Okay, let's see now. One law says if I start on opening day and kill 6 every day, I can shoot down 360 ducks in a season. But the other law says I can't have more than 12 in my deep freezer, so the government apparently wants me to eat them as soon as I shoot them. Now, we like to eat duck more than most people, but the average duck weighs about 1 pound when it's dressed. The government expects me to eat 360 pounds of duck in 60 days? What am I supposed to do with the ducks that I can't eat? Feed them to my dogs? If I'm ever elected president of the United States, and you never know, the first thing I'm going to do is downsize the Department of the Interior. I don't know of any politician who has ever said he would do that. I'd also make sure we have plenty of nesting ground for ducks, so I'd work with our friends in Canada, where most of the ducks are born. I'd take all the money we're sending to the Middle East, where we're trying to pay people to be our friends, and divert it to Canada and earmark it to help raise ducks. We don't need to be sending money to the Middle East. Too many of those people are mean. The Canadians are already our friends, and Canada would be number one on my list for foreign aid. So when I'm elected president, we're going to lower taxes and make sure we give the Canadians truckloads of cash to raise mallard ducks. The American people are tired of pork barrel spending. Let's spend some money on ducks. The bottom line is the U.S. government doesn't have to be so strict about duck hunting. In my opinion, it only needs to educate people about what you can shoot and what you can't shoot. It's a great sport, but it would be even greater if there weren't so many rules and regulations. Of course, I've always been of the opinion that I've been given permission from headquarters to shoot and kill whatever animals I want. According to Genesis, God instructed Noah to build an ark to save himself, his family, and a remnant of all the world's animals after God decided to destroy the world because of mankind's evil deeds. God instructed Noah to build the ark of cypress wood, make rooms in it, and coat it with pitch inside and out. God told Noah to bring into the ark two of all living creatures, male and female, to keep them alive with you. Two of every kind of bird, of every kind of animal, and of every kind of creature that moves along the ground will come to you to be kept alive. After Noah did what God told him to do, the floodgates of the heavens opened on the 17th day of the second month, and rain fell for 40 days and 40 nights. The earth was flooded for 150 days. As Genesis 7:23 tells us, every living thing on the face of the earth was wiped out. People and animals and the creatures that move along the ground and the birds were wiped from the earth. Only Noah was left and those with him in the ark. When the floodwaters finally receded, Noah and his family left the ark. According to Genesis 9:1-3, then God blessed Noah and his sons, saying to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number and fill the earth. The fear and dread of you will fall on all the beasts of the earth and on all the birds in the sky, on every creature that moves along the ground, and on all the fish in the sea. They are given into your hands. Everything that lives and moves about will be food for you. Just as I gave you the green plants, I now give you everything." Now, I'm not a man of great intellectual depth, but it sounds to me like God Almighty has said we can pretty much rack and stack anything that swims, flies, or walks, which I consider orders from headquarters. I have permission from the Almighty to shoot whatever I want. Of course, I'll follow whatever rule or regulation the government puts in place. My days as an outlaw have long been over. I really wonder if the U.S. government has any idea of the cost and work it takes to get ducks to fly to my land in the first place. At last count, we had 54 duck blinds on about 800 acres of our land. As Duck Commander grew and became more profitable through the years, Kay and I had a little bit of money to invest, and we decided to buy land. What I wanted was something I could feel, touch, and stand on, something tangible. When the stock market collapsed a few years ago, a lot of the young bucks came to me crying about all the money they lost on Wall Street. I never could figure it out. They said their money was in a brokerage account they could see on a computer, but then it was gone. Where did the money go? It didn't disappear. Someone had to take it. Where is it? That's why I invest in something tangible like land. No one can take it from me. Our first purchase was a plot of 40 acres in the wetlands near our house. We bought it, then added more land through the years until we accumulated what we have now. Mac Owen, a longtime hunting companion of mine, who appears in many of the Duckman videos, also wanted to get in on the investments. Together, Mac and I bought surrounding land as it came up for sale, usually 40 acres at a time. Our investment has paid for itself many times over, primarily because the land we purchased was the most feasible and economical place for oil and gas companies to cross the Washita River with their pipelines. The fees we collected from the utility companies were more than triple what we paid for the land. I also bargained with the companies to ensure that the duck habitat would not be damaged. In the end, the pipelines were laid in a natural-looking curve. I think the plan may even have enhanced the area's appeal to ducks because I mow the pipeline right-of-way regularly, eliminating brush and encouraging more grass to grow. We have planted, cultivated, and protected the grasses on our land primarily for ducks. Our wetlands are covered with native millets, sedges, and nutgrass, as well as planted stands of Pennsylvania smartweed, American smartweed, and spranglethop, creating a mosaic of wild and cultivated plants. They are all prime foods for wildlife. The grasses are heavy producers of the seeds on which ducks thrive. Millet is one of the best foods available for ducks. In a good year, smartweed can produce more than 5 million seeds per acre. Ducks love them, and their craws are often found stuffed with the small black seeds. Spranglethop is another heavy seed producer, some of its seeds will remain edible for as long as 7 years. That the grasses also sustain crawfish is a bonus. Everything eats crawfish at every stage of a crawfish's life. Fish, birds, raccoons, bullfrogs, snakes, turtles, large water beetles, and humans. Crawfish are a Louisiana delicacy, and we've harvested them to eat and sell. Crawfish are also an important ingredient in the swamp ecosystem, so I do everything I can to propagate them. Shortly after we bought the land in the wetlands, I observed all of the water leaving through one low drainage area on the edge of our land. The water dumped into a creek before emptying into the Washita River. To control the water depth on our land, I built a low levee across the area. I marked the highest level the water reached on trees, which allowed me to determine how high and long to make the levee. As I was building it, I installed a 48-inch culvert through it at the lowest spot, and then put a weir or gate across it to control the water depth. I can adjust the water depth of the wetland 6 inches at a time simply by adding or taking out a top board from the weir. I regulate the flooding of my land in accordance with what crawfish require, which coincidentally meets the needs of migrating ducks as well. The crawfish normally hatch in October when the rains return. They grow through the winter, reaching adulthood in March. Hopefully enough rain will fall to refill the area. If the area isn't filled naturally, I use a big pump to draw water from the river. Normally, I have to do some pumping to ensure that most of my land is covered with water to a depth of 12 to 18 inches, ideal for both the crawfish and duck populations. The depth is determined by how far a duck can stretch its neck to feed when it bobs underwater. After duck season is over, I drain the land to promote the growth of grasses and trees. After we purchased the wetlands, a Louisiana Fish and Wildlife Department survey showed that 65% of the timber in the area was bitter pecan trees, which can grow as tall as 100 feet. The wood is not as desirable as hickory or regular pecan, but it is resilient and is used to make such things as axe and hammer handles. The worst thing about bitter pecan trees is that they drop pig nuts, which taste so bad that most wildlife won't eat them. I set out to eliminate the bitter pecan trees and replace them with oak trees that would produce more palatable fare for a wider variety of wildlife, including both squirrels and deer, which love acorns. It turned out to be a formidable task. After the bitter pecan trees were cut and sold, the following year suckers began to sprout from all the stumps. Left alone, multiple tree trunks would grow from the stumps, and the area would be reforested with bitter pecan trees thicker than before. So I got a lawn trimmer, the kind with a blade, and went from stump to stump, one at a time, and mangled off all the sprouts. Then I treated the stumps with poison to finish killing them off. It took me 3 years to clear them all. Then I was thinking about how to get the area seeded with oaks. I had planted and seeded many oaks and cypress trees, but was still working on it when the Almighty stepped in and flooded everything in the area in 1991. The water picked up acorns and deposited them over all the area I had cleared. When spring came, there were thousands and thousands of oaks of all kinds, sprouting every foot or so. It was a blessing from above. And while the flood destroyed the home where Pa and Granny were living, and its water rose to the front steps of our house, the floodwaters provided us the now heavily wooded areas where we hunt today. About 90% of your success in duck hunting is determined by the location of your duck blind, and we've made major improvements to water conditions, soil conditions, and how natural feed gets to the holes we're hunting. I've kept detailed records of every one of the hunts on our land for more than 2 decades, including specifics about weather, wind direction, types of ducks we saw, and the position of the sun. It's amazing to look back and see how much better the hunting has been over the last few years after the improvements were made. For instance, on opening day of the 1995 duck season, we hunted Dog Bayou, a blind on my land, and we killed 1 mallard, 7 teals, and 1 ringneck. A few days later, we hunted the Dog Bayou and didn't even fire our guns. Good night, we stayed until 2 o'clock in the afternoon and didn't kill a duck. During the 1995 season, we killed 266 ducks in 60 days. Now, we try to average 20 ducks per day between 4 or 5 of us in the blinds. During the first split in 2012, we killed more than 200 ducks in the first 10 days. We've gone from 200 ducks in 1995 to more than 1,000 ducks now. The crazy part is we can make as many improvements as we want to our duck blinds, but they'll never be as good as the ancestral holes. Some of the land next to mine used to be a swamp, but the owners leveled it in the 1960s and turned it into rice fields. Some guys got in a duck blind over there and noticed that ducks kept flying to one particular spot on the field. They asked the farmer why ducks were sitting there, and he told them it's where a lake used to be. The trees and the water are gone, but the ducks are still flying there because it was where the lake once was. It's in their genetic makeup to fly there. It's one of the phenomena of Mother Nature that can't be explained through science. There are a lot of them, and the only explanation I can come up with is that God is in charge and has a blueprint for how everything works. Take, for instance, the Arctic tern, a medium-sized bird, which is famous for flying from its Arctic breeding grounds to Antarctica and back every year, covering more than 43,000 miles round trip. The terns travel down the coast of Brazil or Africa to get to their wintering ground every year. Some evolutionists want us to believe that the reason they fly to Antarctica every year is because once upon a time one tern found its way there, told some terns about it, and then they all started going there. Makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? I, for one, believe the terns were born knowing they had to fly to Antarctica every winter to survive. To prove the point, researchers once robbed a tern's nest and raised the little birds away from their mother. Then they banded them when they were old enough to fly. The terns had never seen Antarctica and had never been around another tern to tell them to fly there. So when it was time for the terns to fly south, the researchers flew over the Arctic Ocean and dropped them from an airplane. The terns made one circle and then flew south, arriving in Antarctica a few weeks later. Why would they do that? Because there were about 20 different life forms that relied on the terns to survive. The Arctic fox couldn't survive without its eggs, and certain plants and worms couldn't live without its droppings. Hawks couldn't survive without feeding on the birds. The terns were part of the food cycle in both the Arctic Ocean and Antarctica. The ducks that fly south from Canada each year and winter throughout Florida, Louisiana, Texas, parts of Central America, and beyond are the same way. Everything from alligators to snapping turtles to skunks rob ducks' nests and eat their eggs. Foxes, coyotes, and birds of prey eat their babies when they're young. Humans hunt ducks too, and they put meat on our tables. It's the Almighty sending literally millions and millions of pounds of protein from one end of a continent to the other end, feeding all of these things along the way. It's like the mayfly on the river. A mayfly starts out as a larva in the water and looks like nothing more than a little maggot. When the water level rises, the larvae crawl up the trees on the riverbank. They build cocoons that look like spider webs and then emerge as flying creatures. You see mayflies flying all over the river, and they live only long enough to drop their eggs into the water. Why? Because when they die and fall into the water, fish come up and eat them. Mayflies are fish food. It's a cycle. Mayflies drop their eggs, and then they die. Fish eat them. The larvae climb up the trees, and then it starts all over again. Who's feeding the fish? The Almighty is feeding the fish. God is feeding everything, including you and me, and a lot of us in his ecosystem eat us some crawfish. Chapter 12, Prodigal Sons. Rule number 12 for living happy, happy, happy. Learn to forgive. Life's a lot easier that way. The good Lord blessed Kay and me with 4 healthy, obedient sons, each of whom grew up to become a godly man who loves his wife and children and shares God's word through his work with Duck Commander and in our church. But I'm not sure I needed to see how they came into this world. A few weeks before our youngest son, Jephthah, was born in 1978, Kay informed me she wanted me at the hospital to witness his birth. Now, I didn't want to be in the delivery room when Jeph was born. When our oldest son, Alan, was born, I wasn't there, and he turned out fine. I wasn't there when Jace came, but everything still turned out okay. When Willie came next, I didn't want to press our luck, so I didn't go to the hospital again. In fact, I was fishing when he was born. But when Kay became pregnant with Jep, she told me it was the last baby we were going to have, so she wanted me beside her to witness God's greatest miracle. Women being the strange creatures they are, Kay decided she needed a coach for the birth of her last child, and she insisted that I was the one to do it. When the day arrived for Jep's birth, Kay decided she was going to deliver him without an epidural or any kind of medication. I knew then that I had a tough woman. Over the next several hours, I watched my wife thrashing around and gritting her teeth, and then I saw Jep's head emerge from my wife's loins. Let me tell you something. I salute womanhood worldwide because women are exceptionally tough for enduring the misery of childbirth. I've cleaned hogs and gutted deer, but in my experience on earth, I've never witnessed such a brutal event. I knew right then that my sex life was over, although I somehow managed to get over my concerns 30 days later. Let me put it to you this way. After going through it once, I'd never go back and do it again. It was rough to watch, so I can't imagine having to experience the pain. If men were in charge of carrying and birthing our babies, we'd have a lot fewer people on earth because we'd only do it once, I can promise you that. Each of our boys was a blessing, and after I repented and had my life in order again, I set out to give them the same sort of childhood I had as a boy, learning to hunt and fish and live off the land. Alan, Jace, and Willie were very close when they were growing up, and then they kind of took Jep under their wings after he was born because there was such an age gap between them. My philosophy on discipline was very simple. Since rules are made to be broken, I kept the rules few and far between. However, there was a code in the Robertson house. 3 licks was the standard punishment. It wasn't 10 licks or 20 licks for doing something wrong. It was always 3. Thump, thump, thump. It was a principle, and my boys always knew what their punishment would be if they stepped out of line. They received 3 licks if they disrespected their mother. As it says in Ephesians 6:1-3, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, so that it may go well with you and that you may enjoy long life on the earth." I never had to tell my boys not to disrespect me. That rule was understood, and it never crossed their minds to break it. None of my sons ever disrespected me, not even once. Nobody ever bowed up and told me I wasn't going to tell them what to do. There was literally flawless obedience when they were living under my roof, at least when I was home. If I told them to go to bed, they jumped up and went to bed. If I told them to rake the leaves, they raked the leaves. If I told them to clean the fish, they cleaned the fish. People would come over to visit us and were amazed at how obedient our sons were. Their teachers always told us our boys were among the most well-behaved students in school. I believe it's because my boys were always aware of the consequences of not doing what they were told to do. They always respected me, and they respected their mother because I didn't want them taking advantage of the woman who put them on earth. I also didn't allow my sons to fight with each other. They could argue and disagree all they wanted, and Jace and Willie managed to do it regularly. I didn't have a problem with them raising their voices at each other to make a point. I wanted to encourage them to argue and make a case for their beliefs. But if it came to blows and there was meat popping, they were getting 3 licks each. I didn't care who threw the first punch. If it ever came to physical blows, I'd step in and everybody involved got 3 licks. Another thing I didn't allow was tearing up good hunting and fishing equipment. I wanted them to respect someone else's property and to be thankful for what we had, even if it wasn't much. If one of the boys borrowed one of my guns or fishing poles and tore it up while they were using it, they received 3 licks. I always wanted my boys to have access to my guns to hunt, just like I had access to Paul's guns when I was growing up. When I was young, I knew if I broke a gun, we probably weren't going to eat that night because we were so dependent on wild game for food. But since my boys knew there was going to be a meal on the table every night, they weren't always as respectful of my equipment. When Alan was about 14, he and a few of his buddies borrowed all of my Browning shotguns to go bird hunting. They were hunting on a muddy track, and because they were careless and immature, mud got into a few of the shotgun barrels. They were very fortunate the guns still fired and didn't blow up in their faces. When Alan returned home, He was so scared to tell me what happened to my Browning shotguns, my holy grails, that he enlisted Kay's help to break the news. I'm sure Alan thought I was going to beat him on the spot, but I simply told him to go outside. I was afraid to whip him right then because I was so angry. After cooling off, I pulled Alan and his buddies together and gave them a stern lecture about gun safety and respecting other people's property. I also told Alan, after I gave him three licks, that he was on probation from using my guns for a long time. There was another time when I discovered that one of my boat paddles was broken. None of my boys would fess up to doing it, so I gave each of them three licks. It was kind of a military-style group punishment. It turned out that one of their buddies actually broke it, but he didn't confess to the crime until several years later. I'm sure he realized that if he'd confessed when the boys were younger, they all would have whipped him. As hard as Kay and I worked to instill morals, principles, and a belief in what's right and wrong in each of our sons, it wasn't always easy. People might watch Duck Dynasty and sometimes think we're the perfect family. They see how much we love and respect each other. But the reality is that it wasn't always easy. We had our trials and tribulations like every other family out there, and there were actually times when Kay and I believed we would lose more than one of our sons. They were the scariest times of our lives. Alan, our oldest son, probably had the roughest childhood because he was the oldest boy when I was having all of my problems. Kay was essentially a single mother for a long time, so Alan was given a lot of responsibility when he was only a young boy. When Kay started working at Howard Brothers discount stores, Alan was only 7 but was left at home to care for Jace and Willie. Alan had to grow up really fast and didn't get to enjoy his childhood or play baseball and other sports like his brothers did, at least not until I turned my life around. Alan also attended 4 or 5 different schools because we moved around so much, which I'm sure wasn't very easy for him either. Alan was a very popular kid in high school, and before long he was hanging out with the wrong crowd. I can remember one time when he and some buddies were camping at a spot down the road from our house. They were drinking beer and did some foolish things, like knocking down mailboxes along the road. Some neighbors came to our house the next morning to complain about it, and I jumped in my truck to find them. I brought Alan and his buddies back to our house and lined them up against my truck. I gave each of them 3 licks. There was one boy I didn't even recognize, but I told him if he ever wanted to come back to the Robertson house, he was getting 3 licks like the rest of them. After Alan graduated from high school, his behavior was so wild and out of control that Kay and I didn't want him around his younger brothers anymore. He was the oldest boy and his brothers looked up to him, but he wasn't setting much of an example for them. So we threw Alan out of our house, which certainly wasn't an easy thing to do. My sister Judy was living in New Orleans at the time, and Alan moved there to live with her. You want to talk about going from the frying pan to the fire? Alan lived in New Orleans for about 2 years, and he started dating a woman. She told Alan she was divorced, but she was really only separated from her husband. The husband followed Alan home from work one day and beat him really bad with an iron tire tool. When a policeman showed up at the scene and talked to Alan, he could sense there was something different about him. "Son, where are you from?" the policeman asked Alan. "West Monroe, Louisiana," Alan told him. "I don't know what went wrong in your life and how you ended up here, but go back to wherever you're living, pack up everything you've got, and go back to your mom and dad. I can tell you're a good boy and just got off track." Alan told me he looked up at the police officer as the sun was shining behind him, and he looked like an angel. Alan believed the police officer was sent by God to help him turn his life around. Alan came home and we greeted him with open arms. We cooked a big meal and celebrated his homecoming. It was like the parable of the lost son in the Bible. In Luke 15:11-24, Jesus tells us that there was a wealthy man with 2 sons. When the younger son asked for his share of the estate, the man divided his property between his 2 sons. Before too long, the younger son left for a foreign country and squandered his wealth through unrighteous living. Then a severe famine wiped out everything, leaving the younger son homeless and hungry. After briefly working as a swine herder, the boy repented and returned home to his father. While he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son." But the father said to his servants, "Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." The incident in New Orleans helped Allen turn his life around. He worked for Duck Commander for a few years, then attended seminary and worked as a pastor at Whites Ferry Road Church in 1988, eventually becoming a senior pastor there. While Allen is still heavily involved in the church and often preaches on Sunday, he rejoined the family business in 2012. He helps maintain our schedules and travels with me to speaking engagements and other appearances around the country. Allen has a calming effect on everyone around him, and he's really good at diffusing situations. He's the one who rides herd around his brothers and is the voice of reason and wisdom among them. Allen and his wife Lisa have two daughters. His oldest daughter, Anna, has been working with Duck Commander since high school. Her husband, Jay, who was a teacher and coach at a high school, started working with us building duck calls during the summer, but now he's with us full time. Unfortunately, we also had to go through some of the same struggles with Jep as he grew older. When Jep was in high school, he was the only boy living at home because his brothers were married and living on their own. The older boys liked to say Jep had it a lot easier than they did growing up. I was still pretty strict on the boy, but our business was doing a lot better, so he probably had a few more luxuries than the older boys did. I'll never forget one night Jep was coming home late and got his truck stuck in a muddy road close to where we live. It was in the late 1990s, so Jep had one of the early cell phones in a bag in his truck. It was after midnight, and he called home and Kay woke me up to get Jep out of the mud. I had a Jeep that I bought brand new in 1974, but it was pretty old by then and the lights didn't work anymore. I usually only drove the Jeep to my duck hole and back, so I had Kay follow me in her car to provide lights for me to see. It was still raining pretty heavily when we got to the field where Jep's truck was stuck. I jumped out of my Jeep to winch his truck out, but then Kay pulled up right next to me, not realizing she'd driven into the soft mud. Now Jep was stuck in front of me, and Kay was stuck behind me. "I'm surrounded by idiots," I screamed. Jep went all the way through middle school without having any problems, and then we sent him to Wichita Christian School, which was pretty expensive. We figured if he went to high school there, he wouldn't get into any wild stuff. But with only 4 or 5 months of high school left, Jep broke up with his girlfriend, and then he started sailing backward. I couldn't believe it and didn't want to believe it, to be honest. He moved into an apartment in West Monroe with his cousin, who was attending college at the University of Louisiana, Monroe. Just like Allen, Jep started drinking, cutting up, and using drugs. We knew Jep was drinking because we could smell alcohol in his breath at church on Sunday if he had been out drinking the night before. Kay would always ask me, "What's that smell?" I'd tell her, "That's whiskey on Jep's breath." Willie was actually the one who brought the seriousness of Jep's problems to our attention. Willie was working with the high school youth group at Whites Ferry Road Church, and he found out Jep had asked one of the kids to go to a bar with him. Willie came to our house and said, "I'm done. We've got to do something right now. I'm just tired of it." We called Allen and decided to have a family intervention. Allen lined everything up, and we were all waiting for Jep when he came to the house one night. Kay was terrified because she was certain I was going to throw Jep out of the house like I'd done with Allen. I told Jep, "Give me the keys to your truck, the one I'm paying for." He pulled the keys out of his pocket and handed them to me. I told Jep what his brothers had told me about his behavior. "Son, you know what we stand for," I told him. "We're all trying to live for God. We're not going to let you visit our home while you're carrying on like this. We're paying for your apartment. We're paying for your truck. You've got a decision to make. You're either going to come home and basically live under house arrest because we don't trust you, or you can hit the road, with no vehicle, of course. Somebody can drop you off at the highway, and then you'll be on your own. You can go live your life. We'll pray for you and hope that you come back one day. Those are your two choices." Jep looked at me, lowered his head, and started pouring out his sins to me. He said he'd been taking pills, smoking marijuana, getting drunk, and on and on. He was crying the whole time as he confessed his sins to us and God. I'll never forget what Jep said next. He looked up at me and asked, "Dad, all I want to ask you is what took you so long to rescue me?" After Jep said that to me, everyone in the room was crying. "You still have a choice," I told him. "Well, my choice is I want to come home," he said. Jace has always been our most straight-laced son, so he was the hardest on Jep when he strayed. "Son, you can't hang out with those people," Jace told him. "Daddy won't let them get to me," Jep said. "Daddy won't, and we won't either," Jace promised him. "But you have to come to all the good things to help you. You've got to find better friends. You can't be running around. You have to break it off with the bad influences." Thankfully, our second prodigal son was coming home. It was a heart-wrenching episode for all of us. Alan was so distressed by his little brother's struggles that he left our house, drove down the road, and then stopped and dropped to his knees and wept in a field. Like Alan, Jep turned his life around after overcoming the struggles of alcohol and drugs. He came to work for Duck Commander and found his niche as a videographer. He films the footage for our Duckman videos and works with Willie on the Buck Commander videos. Jep is with us on nearly every hunt, filming the action from a distance. He knows exactly what we're looking for in the videos and films it, downloads it, edits it, and sends it to the duplicator who produces and distributes our DVDs. Having worked with the crew of Duck Dynasty over the last few years, I've noticed that most people who work in the film industry are a little bit weird. And Jep, my youngest son, is a little strange. It's his personality. He's easygoing, likable, and a lot more reserved than his brothers. But he's the only one who will come up to me and give me a bear hug. He'll just walk up and say, "Daddy, I need a hug." The good news for Jep is that as far as the Duck Commander crowd goes, one thing is for sure, weirdos are in. We covet weirdos. They can do things we can't because they're so strange. You have to have two or three weirdos in your company to make it work. It's truly been a blessing to watch Jep grow and mature and become a loving husband and father. He and his wife Jessica have four beautiful children. Like I said earlier, Jace was the only one of our four sons who stayed the course and never deviated to the right or left. He always looked straight ahead. He never drank, never cursed, and always lived his life the way God wanted him to live. I think one of the reasons Jace and Willie never strayed too far is because they were so involved in the youth group at Whites Ferry Road Church. Willie's only problem was that he believed he was a ladies' man until he met Corey. He was always jumping from one girl to the next until he settled down. It really made an impact on both of them. Jace was always looking out for his brothers. Even though Jace and Willie were very competitive growing up, Jace always had Willie's best interests at heart. One time, Willie and Jace were at a friend's house in high school. Jace walked into the basement and found Willie playing strip poker with some other kids. "What are you doing?" Jace asked him. "Playing strip poker," Willie replied. "You've stripped enough," Jace told him. "Let's go." The thing I really like about Jace is that he's as obsessed with ducks as I am. I rarely took my boys hunting with me when they were very young. In fact, I never took them when I was still an outlaw. "Not this time, boys. We might be running from the game warden," I'd tell them. But after I repented and came to Jesus Christ, I started taking my sons hunting with me, beginning with Alan. Before we moved to where we live now, it was a pretty long haul from town to the Washita River bottoms. Alan got carsick nearly every time I took him hunting, but he didn't think I knew. We stopped at the same gas station every time, and he'd walk around back and lose his breakfast before he climbed back into the truck. I was proud of him for never complaining. I took Jace hunting for the first time when he was 5. He was shooting Pa's heavy Belgian-made Browning 12-gauge shotgun, which he could barely even hold up. It kicked like a mule. The first time Jay shot the gun, it kicked him to the back of the blind and flipped him over a bench. "Did I get him?" Jace asked. I knew right then that I had another hunter in the family, and Jace is still the most skilled hunter of all my boys. I trained Jace to take over the